Hello everyone, welcome back to the show, and returning is Michael Lee Hill. Michael, cheers for connecting again, mate.
Yeah, again and again and again.
It's been a bit of a problem electronically. Skype doesn't help either.
Yeah, it's all good. They can't keep a good man down, right?
That's it. That's it. We'll keep trying.
We got all night.
We do. We do. Now, there's lots to talk about, but before we do that, what I'd like to do is just go over a brief overview of who you are, because there's always new people watching the show and that, you know, haven't come across some of the guests on the show before. So how would you like to go into this in sort of just a brief overview of who you are and how you're known in the field? You're somebody that's filmed a lot of UFOs or crafts over Lake Erie, which is really well known in the States. It's probably some of the best footage I've ever seen. You're somebody also known now as an experiencer with the Anunnaki, and also you've been on, you know, different History Channel shows and things like that, and known for the blood anomaly. So where could we sort of steer with this?
Right on. Well, you know, going back probably about 10 years now, I've lived in East Lake, Ohio, which is going to be prominent in the future and why all this activity has been going on here. But I live very close to Lake Erie, and I'm a musician first and foremost. And I was having band practice here in my house, and we took a break and went into my backyard, and me and the bass player, he was having a smoke, and we seen a craft right over the shores of Lake Erie. And like I said, this is probably about 2005 now, and it blew both of our minds, and it sparked my own curiosity to find out what parks were along the lake. And I started going down around sunset, and I had a camera on a tripod waiting. You know, if a big orb of light showed up, I was sitting there waiting for it, and started to accumulate quite a large library of footage. And some of that stuff, I decided to put it up on YouTube, and it went viral. And now my YouTube page, which is Frozen Hill, it has over 4.5 million views. And that's what brought the History Channel to my front steps. And originally, they just said that they're doing a show on Sky Watchers, and I have about 5 minutes. But what they didn't tell me is they had interviewed another contactee, and his name was Terrell Copeland. And about 2 weeks prior to them coming to the Cleveland area to interview me, they had interviewed him, and he had the same story of contact, the same spiritual bed of information given to him about how mental energy is creating our physical reality, you know. And also, he was his whole message and story of contact was identical to my own. So I didn't know this, and they're probably smart they didn't tell me, because I'm a big baby when it comes to needles. But they had asked me if I'd come to Boston and have a follow-up done to my segment I had filmed for them. And I said sure, and went there and ended up having my blood work done by a Harvard professor. His name was David Systrom. And in that show for the History Channel, it's called Alien Contact. That was the episode of UFO Hunters I was on. It was revealed that I didn't have normal human blood. Neither did Terrell Copeland. That's why he had got an honorary discharge from the military, because they found out he had this anomaly in his blood that none of the best doctors in the world could explain. If you want, I know most people, what was the anomaly, you know? And what it was an increase of an enzyme called creatine kinase into the bloodstream. They said everybody, no matter what, your brain releases this enzyme. Wait a minute, enzyme. and 25 parts per liter of blood is like the normal amount. And if you've had bodily damage, like say you've had a heart attack or you've ripped a muscle during working out or something, your body will increase the amount of creatine kinase into your bloodstream, because it brings extra oxygen into the bloodstream to facilitate healing. And so if normal amounts were 25 parts per liter of blood, mine and Terrell's were just above 2100, which you can imagine, you know, if 25 is the normal, 2100 is where we were at. It's bringing a lot of extra oxygen into the bloodstream, which equates, from what I've understood now, to how much electricity or chi that the body is holding at a cellular level, because all of our bodies are holding a, you know, cellular capacitance at a cellular level. And you know, we can get into this. I know in the past we've talked about being brought into this group of remote viewers, and the head of this was A.R. Borden, but he said out of their group of about 180 people of these, you know, his job was to look for people who had extended physical sensory perception, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. People who had an increase in the sixth sense, I guess you could say. He formed this group, and there was 180 members, and he told me that there's 12 members of my own specific bloodline, and my levels of 2100 would put me in about the middle of those 12. And if you put me at being 2100, he told me the highest was 12,000.
Bloody hell, that's a lot.
Yeah, and he had said that there is such a thing as these, you know, like people don't even know it, but, you know, in the black ops world, there is particle beam weapons and whatnot. He said one of these beams that was, this dude that was at 12,000 got hit by a particle beam weapon, and he got up and just kind of dusted himself off and walked away. And the way it was portrayed to me is that wasn't normal. You know, like most people wouldn't get up from that event. So what I've understood is this is really close to, believe it or not, George Lucas. You know, a lot of people are starting to understand that some of these stories actually have a lot of truth behind them. And the whole thing with the Force and mitochondrions, I guess they're called in the Star Wars world, is very close to what we're talking about with creatine kinase and how much those levels are in the bloodstream and how it equates to chi. But that was in 2008, and that episode, Alien Contact, aired the first season of UFO Hunters. And between you and I and everyone listening, you know, I never knew how the powers that be or the History Channel or whoever owns the History Channel even felt about the episode I was on. But here to find out, Bill Burns, who is the host of the UFO Hunters, and he's also a New York Times best-selling author. In 2013, he released a book called UFO Hunters, The Book. And every chapter was an episode from season one. And a little back story, you know, and what happened behind the scenes and what had happened after the story had aired and what they had found out. And in it, he talked about exactly what we're talking about, of how this unknown blood anomaly was revealed from a Harvard professor. And so that was in March of, I believe, 2008. And in the summer of 2008, that's when the Anunnaki met me for the first time and said, you know, at this time there was no ancient aliens on TV or anything like that. And it was a shock to me. I didn't know what an Anunnaki even was, but they said, we want to talk to you about what was just revealed on the History Channel, because it's truly the revealing of the Nephilim. And they said that the Anunnaki had a Anunnaki human hybrid bloodline on this planet that was called the Nephilim. You go back to the Bible, and the Anunnaki in the Bible were called the Elohim. And it says right there, the Elohim had a Elohim human hybrid, and it was called the Nephilim. And they said I would start to begin to understand what this meant and be able to, that's what I was here to do, you know. And back in 2008, that didn't make any sense to me, but now it's all come into focus. And I guess that's why me and you are even talking right now, because they tell me things are about to change. And, you know, this culture, this intelligence behind truly who made the Sumerian culture and pyramids and temples, which later became the Egyptian culture, they're about to be revealed to humanity for the very first time. And this isn't just my own opinion on these things. I find it very fascinating, and I think we're living in such a wonderful time. It's exciting to me. But Carmen Bolter, who is the woman, she was a doctor who created the TV show for the History Channel called The Pyramid Code, which it's on Netflix. Anyone that, if you want a real eye-opening experience, go to Netflix and just watch The Pyramid Code, or it's available on YouTube also for free. Well, what I can tell you is she's doing a lot of research and in contact right now doing another documentary with the powers that be to release what I'm going to share with you, and that is using satellite-based ground-penetrating radar. And she said this is brand-new technology. It's not... like with old ground penetrating radar, if you went down 50 feet and say there was something under the ground at 50 feet, you would be able to see that. But if there's something 100 feet below it, well, you're out of luck. Once you hit that first level under the ground, that's it. Well, this new technology is actually using quantum computing algorithms. And she said it's so sophisticated that they can actually tell the difference between like silver in gold or artifacts, or it makes a whole dimensional, you know, outlay of information of what it's scanning. And it's not like what they found was 60 feet below the sands in what's called the labyrinth in Egypt. They found a whole complex that some of these rooms are the size of grocery stores. They're massive. And some of the smaller rooms are the size of Olympic swimming pools. And there's so many of these rooms, they scan over a couple of acres beneath the sand. And that the hallways that interconnect these rooms, there's over a mile of hallways on that level, just connecting the different rooms. So you can imagine there's plenty of these rooms, and she said they know they're all filled with gold and artifacts. And but that's at 60 feet. Now below that, because they have this new technology, at 110 feet there's a whole nother level that mirrors that 60 foot level, and it's another whole acres of rooms connected by hallways. And but there's nothing connecting level A at 60 foot to level B at 110 foot. And she said that she doesn't believe in these researchers that are looking into this. It was never above ground. It was created right where it sits, 60 and 110 feet below the sand. And that's just one example of what humanity has in the very near future of being revealed. And in the same way, people will understand that in the early 1900s, the only thing of the Sphinx that was above the sand was its head. And it wasn't until they excavated the rest of the body in the early 1900s that they seen, you know, the body of the Sphinx for the first time. They said in the same way, there's hundreds of pyramids still under the sand that they know is there using this ground penetrating radar. And these pyramids have never had the outer casings ripped off of them like we did in the pyramids we know of in Giza. And these pyramids are in pristine condition. And imagine when those are unearthed, right? You know, I think it's exciting because truly there's a whole history of mankind, and it does deal with extraterrestrials. It does deal with, you know, races of intelligence that's been here for a very long time that we've not been privy to. And to me, it's like, who is anyone on this planet that can tell you or I what we're allowed to know about our own history of our own people? I didn't give them that right. I know you didn't. You know, just because they think that they know, you know what I'm saying, the Catholic Church or whatever, you know, the Vatican archives. How about we just release everything that's in the Vatican archives so humanity gets a bigger picture of its true history? I think that's really what we're on the verge of, and I think it's magnificent.
We're definitely on the verge of some really big changes at the moment. And look, talking to you over, it would be nearly a year and a half, 2 years I've been talking to you now, and, you know, I'm an experiencer also, but what I'm noticing with with all people that are experiencing stuff is that when things start, it's hardcore. The experiences are hardcore. And look, with your footage too, you can't debunk it. It's over and near a nuclear facility. There's witnesses to it. These things aren't satellites. They're popping in and out. They're doing maneuvers. And then you're having experiences on top of that. And these things are life-changing. Every single facet of your life changes when these things start. But what's happened is an exponential change later on, which I'm seeing with you and myself in terms of where the experiences take you. You start to embrace things. You start to know things. You start to, I guess, go in self-mastery mode instead of going elsewhere for answers. You start going within, and you're guided to who you need to be guided to. Now, with you, it's been like that as well since you've been on the, you know, filming crafts, having your experiences, and you've been on the been on TV and that. You've gone into a lot of different areas, and you know, you had AR Borden, you know, talking to you and sharing a lot of information with you. How's things for you now in terms of where things are going? Do you expect the unexpected now? Are you just open to whatever's going to happen? Because that's sort of how things play out, doesn't it?
Yeah, man. All I've learned is to roll with it. You know what I mean? Because where it's led me in my own knowledge, it's nothing I could have ever prepared myself for or tried to grab the wheel and steer this vehicle in that direction. It is what it is. And the biggest part of this to me and what I'm here for, you know what? That's probably my Facebook. I'm going to shut that off so we don't have blinking in the background. You know, I think that what I'm here to share, because what happened with my blood anomaly, and this was in 2008, at this point, because of my being adopted, I didn't know my own heritage. I didn't know I was Native American Indian. It wasn't until I met my biological mother in the end of 2008, and I met my two sisters for the first time, that I found out that I'm Iroquois Indian. And I didn't know the history of the Iroquois and how it even related to America and the formation of America and how our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin and so forth, they went to the Seneca, because there was actually a flourishing culture. And this is what's been hidden from the world up until now, of who the mound builders are, right? You know, the mound builders are the ones that built all these earthwork structures through Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York. And in Ohio specifically, you got the Serpent Mound, which it was just revealed through mainstream science. It's older than anyone ever dared to even imagine. And you get the Newark Earthworks in Newark, Ohio. And so who was this culture that, what I've discovered because of my being a musician and being fascinated with the idea of frequency. And once you understand that everything is frequency, the universe is being sung into existence. Everything's rotating, everything's vibrating from the atom to the galaxy. If it's vibrating, there's frequency, right? So, and even more so why this is important, it was just revealed that they understood that even on a cellular level, that up until now, they thought cells communicated via electricity, kind of like neurons firing in a brain. They said now they know that that's not accurate. Cells are communicating via sound. So it would be utmost of importance to understand what frequencies cells are even communicating with. And once you understood what the natural cosmic harmonious frequencies were, you could start to even tap into the communication between cells. Imagine the health benefit of that. It would eradicate anything that we even know of as disease or cancer or whatever, because at that point we could understand the communication from cell to cell. What I found out is that everything revolves around a cosmic frequency of 432 hertz. And man, this is gonna jump into the deep end right away. And I guess we'll just go there because, you know.
The audience is ready for it, or most of them are anyway.
Right on. Well, 432, man, it's, you find out that our whole counting system, and, you know, what is a hertz? Well, it's how many waveforms. You know, everyone knows sound is a wave, and bass frequencies have less mountain peaks in that waveform, and that's why they go on longer. It's why when you go to a concert, you can hear those bass frequencies outside of the venue. You can, or a car is going down the street and they got those subwoofers going and you can hear that thump. Those waveforms have less peaks and they go longer. And the human hearing goes from 20 hertz up to about 20,000 hertz. Mm-hmm. And the higher you go, the higher the frequency, and the higher. Take a bass and treble on your stereo in your car. Well, bass goes from anywhere. They say human hearing starts about 20 hertz. About 100 hertz is where they set that bass dial on your stereo. And up to 20,000 hertz is the very highest that human hearing, you know, can detect. Well, 432 hertz, which, as what I was saying, a hertz is a way of measuring how many waveform peaks and valleys are per second. And you go, well, who decided it was a second, right? Well, it goes back to Sumeria and the whole counting method we were given by the Sumerians. And you find out, well, they've given us the standard of multiplying or dividing a whole unit by 12, whether it's 12 apostles or 12 astrology signs or, you know, down the line, the 12 hours in a day. Well, take 12 hours in a day, and what you find out, just do the math. It's real easy. Take a second. There's 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour. Keep going until you get to 12 hours. It's 43,200. It's 432. They've been guiding us into this information of, because what I'm telling you is, let's back up. Say you knew nothing about what the most harmonious frequencies. People know now of this subject called sacred geometry, mm-hmm. and that everything, the Fibonacci sequence, the golden mean, you know, everything in existence from an atom to a galaxy is inherent creating these forms into physical reality, whether it's the Fibonacci. And it doesn't matter whether you're an extraterrestrial on another galaxy or here, all physical reality is being created adhering to these sacred geometry. Well, not only can you get the geometry through high math and algebra or whatever, now what they've discovered is frequency alone creates geometry. And they found it out through a scientific endeavor called cymatics. And cymatics was making the invisible visible. It started off with taking a plate and just putting sand on the top of it. And it would be, say it was tuned to a specific frequency. And, you know, you'd take a bow and you make that plate sound and you watch the sand dance. And geometry would form, and it wasn't random. Every time you hit a specific frequency, this specific geometry formed in the sand, and it evolved to a point where now they're using water as the medium, and it was suspended in a tripod so no frequencies could get into it. And then they would have a waveform generator where they could pump frequency through the water, and a high-tech camera that would be there to take a snapshot of what was forming in the water. And what they found out, like I said, say you know nothing about sacred geometry or harmonious frequencies that create geometry in a physical medium. Well, just like in your car, say you get on your radio dial and you start with low frequencies and you start to do a frequency sweep from low frequencies to high, sooner or later you start to tune into a station. Mm-hmm. And you get to a point where that station is the cleanest signal possible. And then you move up higher and you start to lose that signal. And there's more and more noise until it's nothing but noise again. And you keep going higher and you tune into another station. Well, similarly, it's the same with this. What we're talking about, you take this vat of water and you do a frequency sweep from low to high frequencies. And at certain thresholds, you'll notice that perfect geometry is formed within this medium. And then look and see what frequencies you're on, right? It hasn't, you don't do it vice versa. It's not someone's opinion. It's scientific. You go, oh, right here, we're getting perfect geometry. Here's where we're at and frequency. What they found out was 432 hertz was like the magic number that all physical reality is being formed from. And why this is so important is it gets into two crop circles that showed up in Italy, one in 2010 and one in 2011. And both of these crop circles were encoded with ASCII binary code. And the 2010 one encoded E equals MC squared, which we know that's Einstein, you know, his famous, most famous equation of how energy is formed. But E is energy, M is mass, and C is the speed of light squared. So what we know from quantum physics in our leading science is everything is both particle and wave simultaneously. If you think of E equals MC squared, it's only the particle part of the equation. It's mass. It's right in the equation. There's no frequency component to E equals MC squared. But what you find out, 432 hertz squared is the speed of light. Within 1% accuracy, scientifically, perfectly, it's the only frequency. 431 won't get it, and 433 won't get it. 432 squared is the speed of light. So it's given us the frequency component to plug into the E equals MC squared. Because what happened is you got 2010 and this crop circle shows up in Italy and it's encoding E equals MC squared. The next year is a seven-pointed star showed up and it had Ea Inci of the Anunnaki encoded into that crop circle. The seven-pointed star, using this bed of scientific inquiry that I'm telling you about, cymatics, the science of making the invisible visible, what you find out is a 27 hertz frequency creates that seven-pointed star exactly. And that seven-pointed star, so first of all, it's pointing you towards the 432 frequency. Mm-hmm. This needs to be understood, like every frequency, you know, if you're on a piano, and let's just say you have that A note on your piano, everything's tuned properly instead of 440 where we've been put into our musical standard of today across the world is 440. It's not accurate. 432 is where we need to be. But let's just say we do have the piano tuned properly. Well, say you hit that note on the piano and it's an A. Well, if you go to the left, there's a lower A. You know what I'm saying? And then another lower A as you move to the left on the piano. How you, even mathematically, Pythagoras is the one that discovered it's either multiplying or dividing that frequency by two. Mm-hmm. So to go to its lower frequency, if you're at an A note of 432 hertz and you go to its lower frequency, it's going to be 216. 216 and 216 is 432. Then the lower octave is going to be 108 because 108 and 108 is 216. 216 and 216 is 432. Keep working it backwards. What you got is 432, 216, 108, 54, and 27. You'll never have a 27 hertz frequency unless you're tuned properly to 432, four octaves above it. That seven-pointed star is what I found out even from the Native American Indian side. Look at what the Cherokee emblem is for the Cherokee Nation. It's a seven-pointed star. Check out what the Babylonian world map is that's sitting in a museum right now, you know, this artifact from the Sumeria time frame. It's a seven-pointed star. There's a Native American elder, his name is Bear Cloud, and he released a book called The Seven Fires. And I had been guided into trying to understand the significance of the seven-pointed star. And when I was invited, which we'll get to this with the Star Knowledge Conference last year, he was set up right next to me. And I went over and I opened his book and I had been guided into understanding well, beginning to understand the significance of the seven-pointed star. The first thing I opened up his book and I seen a seven-pointed star. I'm like, well, I'll buy this book, thank you. You know what I mean? And what it blew my mind, because he said that once mankind starts to understand that the seven-pointed star can be produced like micro and macro, fractally, perfectly, it'll make mankind enter a new age of energy, free energy, and understanding how physical, you know, energy truly works. And I think this is all works back to these two crop circles that were given to us, one in 2010, one in 2011. One is E equals MC squared in 2010. 2011, you have the seven-pointed star with Ea Inki around it, and it's pointing us into the significance of the 432 hertz frequency via the 27 hertz, four octaves below 432. I know this gets into a lot of math, but it's really not that hard.
Yeah,
it's not hard to follow. But you understand then, 432 squared is the speed of light. It is C in the E equals C squared equation by Einstein. So it starts to guide you into the proper frequencies that are truly components of light. 432.
So it's sort of a precursor to the information of where it's leading. It's like, this is a sign for this with the 432. But from there, that's sort of like, if you get that and the basis of that, you're starting to understand how energy and frequency works. Would you say that's sort of what the meaning for that is?
Yes, yeah. Perfectly. And what has come to me, because the reason that this is even important to me is, as you know, after the History Channel, you know, I was met by the Anunnaki. And at this time, there was no ancient aliens. They told me we've been known in the past as the Anunnaki, and you would understand what this meant in the future. And what I've found out is these earth mounds that we're talking about, this is unknown at this moment, and I think it's mind-blowing, but all of these mound builder sites throughout Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York, most of them have, there's a square and a circle as part of the layout and, you know, the actual structure of these mound sites. What we're talking about is these most harmonious frequencies are encoded into the layout of these mound builder sites in Newark, Ohio. Some of the walls will be 2,160 feet long. Well, it's 216. It's one octave below 432. Another wall will be 1,080 feet long. That's 108. That's two octaves below, you know, 432. Over and over again through these mound builder sites all throughout Northern America, and they're ancient, was this the most harmonious cosmic frequencies were encoded in the actual layout. And it's like they've been waiting for us all this time. They've been guiding us. And it's even, like I said, none of this would even make sense if we hadn't adopted their system of counting time, which is all purposes, it's 1 second, right? Well, where did 1 second come from? It came from Sumeria and our timekeeping that was given to us by them, and language and the whole system of culture, really, that just showed up out of nowhere. So I find it very fascinating that it's almost like they've been waiting for us to evolve to the point that we would start to understand these frequencies and what had been encoded for us very long time ago. And it all does reveal around 432, because picture this, we just said, like, to go lower, right, it's 432 divided by 2, which gets 216 for the one octave lower. Mm-hmm. But you going higher, 432 would be 864 if you go to the next higher octave. Well, if 12 hours in a day equals 43,200 seconds. Well, if you double 12 hours, you're going to get 864. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It lies in perfectly with what we're talking about. It hasn't been understood to this point, but I think right now it's of utmost importance to understand what these frequencies mean to physical reality and the creation of light into physical matter. And, you know, for instance, Michael Tellinger showed this older gentleman who started building these devices that emitted a frequency. And I can guarantee you these frequencies were within this grid work that we're talking about. And when he put it down in the water would instantly begin to boil. Instant energy from putting this frequency into a physical medium. And right now, even musically, in the 1940s, we were changed from the 432 hertz frequency into 440. And 440, using the same scientific equipment, it's not my opinion, it's not my theory, use the scientific data and pump a 440 hertz frequency through it, what you'll find, no geometry is formed. It's just about the least harmonious frequency you can choose out of nature. And what you'll find is, for a very long time in human history, in Eastern cultures especially, they knew they had someone that was part of the kingdom, and it was their job to go out into the kingdom and make sure people were tuned properly, their musical instruments. And Confucius said, if you want to know the level of a culture you're dealing with, look into their quality of music. Mm-hmm. By quality of music, he wasn't talking about whether you're writing Beatles songs, you know. What he's talking about is the quality of frequency that you're communicating. Because put it this way, using this scientific equipment, you put 440 through it, our today's musical standard, no geometry is formed. Put through that same medium, same scientific equipment, same guitar even, tune it down to 432. Now it's like you took a focus on a camera and just made it come into perfect focus. There's more information in the signal, even physically. You know, so the way to even start to understand this is forget everything. Instead, if you take an acoustic guitar, if you're tuned to A equaling 440 hertz, if you just tune your instrument down to 432 hertz, which is just a slight hair difference to the human ear, you'll gain about one third the decibel level of where you were at 440. Because if there's more information in the signal, there's more amplitude and the signal is being communicated out of that instrument even. So imagine just being able to gain one third of volume from your musical instrument because you went from 440 to 432. And 432 is a true frequency of light. It's what everything in physical reality is being created from. See the benefit of starting to understand what these frequencies are that physical matter is being created from. And then you start to understand that, man, they've been trying to tell us this for thousands of years, but they just couldn't do it, I guess, you know? Couldn't just give us the answers ourselves. We had to evolve to the point where we would start to make sense of the information that was given to us. And to me, it's a huge, huge piece of the puzzle because work backwards, you know, what's been found out is this culture that created these mound sites have become known as the mound builders of Northern America. These mound builders then intertwined into the Native American Indian tribes. What I found out, and this is coming from not only the Native American Indian side, being from the elders, the chiefs, and the grandmothers themselves, they said that in the American Indian side, they know it's through their own culture that the mound builders were the remnants of the Atlanteans. And they just never shared this information with the rest of us because they'd be slaughtered. Yeah. You know, they were slaughtered because they're dancing around a fire. It wasn't Christian, in quotes, you know. Here, what we need to understand is these people had the answers. They're one of the oldest bloodlines on this planet. You know, pre-diluvial or whatever they call it, you know, and especially, man, this people don't even know. It's been proven now in today's science that there is such a thing as cellular memory that's passed down from generation to generation.
The epigenetics. So, yeah.
Yes, indeed. So what does it mean then if you're of a bloodline that has one of the oldest bloodlines on this planet? Well, you have a more larger pool of life experience that's recorded into your Akashic records, into your cellular memory, that you have as a pool to resource your decisions upon. Whether you know it consciously or unconsciously, it's still there. And so what Edgar Cayce said, and this is what's being proven right now to be accurate, which is amazing to me, because between you and me and the audience, yeah, I never gave much credit to, not that I didn't give credit, but, you know, Edgar Cayce just wasn't a part of my interest, you know. But here he said that the Atlanteans, he said, first of all, we need to understand it wasn't one earth change that broke up Atlantis. It was three. And one goes back about 50,000 years, was the first earth change that started to break up the continent that we now know of as Atlantis. Another one was at 25,000 years ago, and he said the 25,000 years ago was the biblical flood event, where there was a pole shift, and, you know, the crust slipped on the planet, and this whole experiment, which we can get into, why the Nephilim was even created, was so they could try to help and incarnate as human into this realm. And this is such an important piece of the puzzle, because I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I'm tired of the negative viewpoint from people like Michael Sarian and David Wilcock, and even, you know, so many people have put the Nephilim into this evil category of the ones that are truly behind the scenes of the Illuminati and the New World Order. What I'm telling you is the true Nephilim came in through Atlantis, became the mound builders, and intertwined into the Native American Indians. What does that have to do with the Illuminati? Nothing. The Native American Indians have suffered the largest genocide on this planet under this machine that was the Illuminati and these English bloodlines. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like a missing piece of the puzzle, where truly the Nephilim came from Atlantis long ago, and Edgar Cayce called the Atlanteans the Poseidians. Well, you might as well call them the Inkyites, right? Inky is Poseidon. Inky is the man from Atlantis, the water bearer, you know, the good brother. Even through the Native American Indian side, what I started to realize because of meeting the Anunnaki, like, take for instance, they say that seven Anunnaki females took the embryos that became mankind into their own bodies and birthed humanity. It wasn't like they took these genetically modified embryos and brought them to term within their own physical bodies, then gave birth to the first seven humans. You get to the Native American Indians, and they have seven grandmothers over all the tribes. You see what I'm saying? So, like, I asked one of the grandmothers, I said, you know, in the Anunnaki, there was a good brother, bad brother. You got Enki and Enlil, right? Through the Native American side, there are whole mythologies on a good brother, bad brother story. And they had seven mothers who gave birth to humankind. And that's the story of the Anunnaki as well. So I asked them, is it a coincidence that these stories are matching up? And they said, no, you're absolutely on the right path. And what I'm telling you is within 5,000 years of written history of the Native American Indians and 10,000 years of oral history, they knew that the Atlanteans became what was known as the mound builders. And the mound builders then later down the line intertwined into the Native American Indian tribes. That has nothing to do with the Illuminati or the New World Order or these European skull and bones type of secret societies. So anytime I want the, if anything that the listeners are going to take from this, look into haplogroup X. It's an actual DNA genotype where they can see where a specific DNA lineage came from on this planet. And in 1997, which isn't that long ago, they found a brand new DNA lineage and they named it haplogroup X. And what they found out is the most that it was ever found on this planet was in the tall skeletal remains of these skeletons that were removed out of these earth mounds. They said 3% of this haplogroup X DNA still exists to this day through the Native American Indians. Well, first of all, right there, man, we need to stop and say it's out of our opinion and what you and I believe. A couple generations ago, haplogroup X DNA were giants. There's giant skeletal remains that were removed out of these earth mounds, like Serpent Mound. You'll find out that a skeleton was removed out of a mound that was very close. It's like, you know, 1/5 of a mile away from the Serpent Mound. It's a short walk is the smaller mound, and that's the one that someone drove their truck up on recently. I don't know if you've seen that, you know, Serpent Mound mounds were vandalized recently. But anyhow, yeah, man, someone got drunk, you know, and decided to take their truck up on a mound and do some donuts on it. It's just ridiculous. But what you'll find out is that mound, a giant skeleton, was actually removed, and it went into the Smithsonian. It's verified, and it was 7 foot, but it was removed like there was no bones from the knee down. For some reason, they removed the knee, shin, and foot bones. So it was still 7 foot. Mm-hmm. So if you put on the shin bone, the knee bone, and the foot, that being was probably 10 foot, right? Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you is a couple generations ago, haplogroup X were giants to the fact that there were 8 to 15 feet tall humanoid life forms. Right now, that DNA still exists on this planet, but they're no longer giants. So right there, something needs to be answered, right? To me, it's like this starts to explain what abductions are about. That this genetic work, it's not finished. You know, they knew that the Nephilim had to be reduced in stature to do its job and blend in and not stick out like a sore thumb, you know? And so that's my own opinion. If someone else has a theory on how these giants became normal-sized humans, then I'm all ears. You know what I mean? But these are the kind of questions that I think this path of inquiry is taking us into, and it's good conversation. But getting back to what the Native American Indians know, they know that the mound builders are the true Nephilim. They are the Inki Anunnaki bloodline on this planet. And so when people bring to this forefront this fear-based negative thought form of the Nephilim are the ones who are behind all the world's problems and pulling the strings behind the scenes, man, ask them, what does that have to do with the Native American Indians? I can tell you, most of the people that are spouting this fear porn, this is a part of the story they don't know. And they're just regurgitating shit that they've heard from other people who themselves don't know the bigger picture of the story. Because if the Native American side of the Nephilim and who the mound builders isn't part of the story, then they're only giving you half of the story. And as far as I'm concerned, man, no truth has ever been gained by just looking at half of a story.
Definitely. And that's where even I was cautious in the beginning. I was more afraid of the ridicule and the stuff coming at me, because it's very much similar along the lines as yourself and James Gilliland on the point of the Anunnaki, in terms of, you know, not everything's good, but not everything's bad. And these, everyone's saying they're reptilian and they're this and that. They don't know what they're talking about. And if I ask them if they've had an experience, they haven't.
Yeah.
They just don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, they're just regurgitating what they've been told. And really, they're adhering to the Vatican line, man. You know, the Nephilim, first of all, in the Bible, they were known as the men of renown. These were men who did great things for humanity and went above and beyond, even in a lot of times against their own safety, to try to do something good for humanity. And then somewhere along the line, the Nephilim, by the church, was turned into the fallen angels. And, you know, something God was pissed off about. Well, that's any talk to me of recent researchers who just spout this fear-based Anunnaki Nephilim storyline without the mention of the Native American Indians, well, they don't know the whole story. I guess that's what we're here for, you know, and on your radio show right now, because, man, it's not our opinion. It's haplogroup X. Again, type in go to Google, type in haplogroup X, and just see where your research leads you. It is the true Nephilim bloodline on this planet. I am the haplogroup X. I am Iroquois Indian. And so what happens is you find out that 10,500 years ago was the last break of Atlantis. And they went to this continent of Atlantis, sat between the North American continent and the European continent. And 10,500 years ago, they went to the left. And the last earth change that sunk Atlantis, they went up into the bottom of the North American continent. And the first indigenous people that they met were the Mayans. They taught them the Mayan calendar, you know, pyramid building, higher mathematics, you know, all of this. But this experiment to accelerate human consciousness by making us experience our own mental energy in an unbiased way, you know, negative or positive, it was well underway because this experiment was during the last flood and why the Nephilim was even brought here. And as we said, that was like 25,000 years ago. So this 10,500 years ago, this experiment was well underway as why the Nephilim was even here. And it was letting us experience our own. They understood that thought forms have an electromagnetic reality. We are like radio transmitters ourselves that are sending out these frequencies. And the truth of the matter is we find out that lower frequencies have lower geometry or simpler geometry attached to them. You can see it with this new equipment, cymatics, that I'm talking about. And as you go higher, you hit certain thresholds, and instead of being two-dimensional, this geometry will switch into a three-dimensional version of itself. Then even higher, it'll go through another dimensional threshold where it becomes more dimensional. And they said, really what we need to understand is, say your DNA, when you're born, you're plugged into, say the mass consciousness is plugged into one single 100th monkey type mass consciousness for humanity. And when you're born, you're plugged into that belief system. Through your DNA, the moment of your birth, all the hopes, dreams, fears, and doubts of the mass consciousness become your own, and it's plugged into your DNA at your moment of birth. Well, think of your DNA as a physical, two-dimensional intertwining of DNA strands, right? The double helix. Mm-hmm. Well, think of physical waveform as being non-physical. It's thought, right? But lower thought forms of fear have simpler geometry. Thought forms of love and more feelings that are more along with evolution and the flow of life have higher dimension, have higher geometry. So picture your DNA as this two-dimensional thought form of double helix DNA, and then the waveform of thought superimposed over it. So you have non-physical thought form over DNA, a physical thought form. Where they overlap is where codons form. And no one could ever understand why codons form, where they form within the DNA strand. What they're now finding is it's almost like self-evolution, that when you begin to weed the fear and doubt out of your own belief system, you rise your own frequency, creating more connection points from your mental energy to the DNA. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because thoughts of love have a higher complexity of geometry associated with them, it creates more connection points of that non-physical overlay of the waveform of thought of love, creates more connection points when it's superimposed over DNA. And since there's more connection points, it's almost like, you know, A.R. Borden's group, they called it a bootstrap evolution. It's like you grab your own pants, start to pull them up and, you know, put the shoulder straps on, and no one else can do it for you or me or anyone. It's self-actuating process of you take control of your own evolutionary process by starting to weed the fear and doubt out of your own belief system. So all these things I think need to be taken into account because they understood these principles we're talking about, how thought becomes reality. So very long ago, they split into two camps. Mm-hmm. I call them Team Good Cop and Team Bad Cop. You know, Team Bad Cop, it's their spiritual purpose to look out over mass consciousness of humanity. And if someone's vibrating fear, they would make sure you got a chance to experience your own fear-based thought form in the flesh, because that's truly the only thing that can transmute it into its higher octave of love. Because even like Einstein, it proved that energy, it can't be created or destroyed. It needs to be transmuted. Well, how do you transmute a negative thought form? No one's really asked the question. Well, you live it, you know, it comes up in your own personal reality. So you can see it and go, you know, this shit keeps happening in my life over and over again. It's different people, but it's because you haven't transmuted it. The minute you transmute that thought form and choose love, because if you just choose fear the way that you have been, not you personally, but you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I know exactly what you're saying, and you're exactly right.
It'll just keep happening. You'll go, why does the same shit keep happening to me? Well, you've not transmuted it. That's why, you know, and there's no one else that can do it for any of us. You and each one of us has our own baggage. And I heard this is very similar. Like A.R. Borden said, you know, we all have come across the idea that mental energy creates our physical experience, that belief creates reality. So what we don't understand is most people's mental energy does not affect mass consciousness, because they haven't, if you like, take the seven deadly sins, right? Gluttony, sloth, envy, you know, the rest of them. Every single one of us, when we get plugged into mass consciousness, we all have attributes of those attributes within our own psyche. Mm-hmm. And until they're balanced and healed within ourselves, you're not granted extra manifesting ability by the creator, because you just create more darkness. If you haven't had those seven things healed within yourself, it's known on a higher level. Well, if you're given manifestation ability, like light encoded reality matrix, you know, the Tibetans called it tulpas, where they would put their mental energy on a thought form of a revered monk with such tenacity that that monk would appear in the real world. And others could perceive it as well. It wasn't just an illusion or a manifestation. Well, the Anunnaki understood this, that for a negative thought form, it needs to be experienced in that perceiver's reality for them to transmute it. So their spiritual purpose was to see if individual A was putting fear out, they'd make sure you got a chance to experience your own dark baggage in hopes you transmute it into love. They couldn't do it for anyone, you know, but that's only Team Bad Cop.
Yeah.
I think this is why when you hear a lot of people talk about the Anunnaki, you'll get a lot of negative and people saying, well, they're the ones that are truly behind everything. Well, if you just focus on Team Bad Cop, I can guarantee you it's going to be an ugly story.
And that's what they'll attract.
Yeah, man, it is what it is. And if, you know, if you are a human that has a lot of fear and doubt and bullshit in your own belief system, and you come across a multidimensional being whose spiritual purpose it is to make you experience your own negative thought forms, well, I can guarantee you, you're not going to have a pleasant experience. More than likely, you'll view that being as a demon because they're making you experience all your own dark baggage. And but it is our own baggage, and there is always Team Good Cop. Mm-hmm. There's always the Anunnaki who is guiding us into sacred geometry and music, and you know, you get people like Da Vinci and Pythagoras who started to understand these things, and it rose, and they say it's holographic. Once you start to understand some of these concepts, their genius would sprout into every facet of their being. Like Da Vinci, across the board, he was a genius. And Pythagoras, it was music and geometry and how geometry becomes physical. Everything started to just come into focus for him. That is Team Good Cop's work. Team Bad Cop will make you experience your own negativity. And it's up to each one of us to, you know, we're not, you know what I'm saying, you know, we're not at either one of their
beck and call. It's basically do this on our own back. And this is where I think, and you would know this as somebody who's an experiencer yourself, a lot of your own shit and baggage is brought up, because what I call this is self-mastery 101. And people go, well, I have an experience as well. The true fact is everyone's an experience, but you're not going to have the stuff that people would deem hardcore happen because you can't even deal with your own shit. How are you going to deal with something that's multidimensional and is either pulling you astrally or physically somewhere else or vice versa? You're bringing that to you. You just can't deal with it. So this is where... It's a balance of both sides, and they're really in a way of self-service mode. Something might seem like self-service. Then you've got the service mode side. With the self-service side of things, what it does is it brings up your own stuff to evolve, and I think that's what's happening is we've got a polar thing going on here of, you know, you look at positive or negative. When you have both, it grows you to evolve. You don't stay in the same state. And this is where we need both sides to evolve, or else everything is going to be the same and there's going to be no use of anything even going on.
Yeah, man. You know, this exact thing we're talking about, I'm a huge Graham Hancock fan. And for the listeners, go look into, it's on YouTube. It's a documentary he did called The Quest for the Lost Civilization. And in it, he had in this ancient temple, he found this mural that was engraved in a wall, and it's pretty much the Anunnaki's idea of spirituality and things we're talking about. And it was called The Myth of the Churning of the Milky Ocean. And what he said was, in their own mindset, the Milky Ocean was the most important part of this mythology, because to them, this Milky Ocean is what the whole universe of all the galaxies and all the suns and all the planets rested in. And he said, in this ocean, this Milky Ocean, there was two teams of churners, a team of light and a team of darkness. But what wasn't understood yet is, he said, and there's, in his own words, he said, there's great spiritual wisdom concealed in this, that they weren't at war with one another. It wasn't about the light beating the dark or the light or the dark beating the light. The fact of the matter was they were working in cooperation to turn the evolution of mankind into the higher realms. And pretty much what I think what they're saying is the Anunnaki will become whatever we need to evolve, demon or angel. If you want to go dark side, yeah, it is the trickster. It is the trickster. That intelligence that we're up against, whatever we need, it will become, and it'll reflect itself back to you in hopes that if you want to go dark, it'll go dark with you and show you where that path leads, which I can guarantee you it will not be fun. It will, you know, it won't be what you think it is, because truly it's not pro-evolution and it's not pro-life. It is not going with this flow of energy that is making this whole existence even, you know, possible for us. So I think that mythology in itself, but what I can tell you and why this is important is when I met the Anunnaki in 2008, they said this whole experiment of duality, of bringing this experiment to accelerate human conscious evolution by making us experience our own mental energy in an accelerated fashion would end the day of the age of Aquarius. And they said that their whole way of dealing with humanity changes with the processional cycle. And I can tell you, between me and you, I didn't even know at that time what a processional cycle even was. So the more I looked into this, I start to understand, yeah, all these ancient cultures based everything around the processional cycle. And that's why the whole idea of entering into the age of Aquarius, you find out the age of Aquarius, well, Aquarius is the guy holding the bucket of water. Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? It's Enki. Enki is the man holding the bucket of water. He was always depicted in Sumeria as either water erupting from his shoulders and fish and the water tumbling down, or he was holding buckets of water, and people were like, what's he carrying a purse for? Well, it wasn't a purse, it's a bucket of water. He is the water bearer. So you see, Aquarius is Enki. The age of Aquarius might as well be called the age of Enki. When you go back to Atlantis, it is Enki. He is the man from Atlantis, the king of Atlantis, the Poseidians. Poseidon was the king of the water. You know, it's the same archetype of intelligence all throughout history. The Maitreya in the Tibetan culture, he's depicted with water erupting from his shoulders. It's the same intelligence being incarnated into different pools of humanity to try to make us evolve. And that's my own bloodline that I've realized now is I am Mound Builder, Iroquois, Indian, Inky bloodline here on this planet. And I guess that's why we're doing this interview right now, is to reveal everything that we're talking about, because truly there's a huge part of human history that has been kept from humanity. And who is the Vatican archive to keep this information from you and I? I didn't give them that authority. You know, did you? You know, who can, you know, how, who are they to say that we're not allowed to know our own history as a race and people? And so I'm really, really excited for the future of revealing who these people were. And, you know, right now we're going back to Sumeria. They, you know, our scientists say 4,000 or 5,000 years ago was the first point of human history. Well, we're pushing back now to 50,000 years ago and what was going on. We'll even go further than that, because I'm sure once they reveal what's truly in these written history in stone, so to speak, in these stone tablets that are hidden in the Vatican archives, and we reveal more of, like I said, these complexes that are still hidden under the sand, we're going to learn this larger history. And it has nothing to do with my own opinion or, you know, my own contact with the Anunnaki. It's going to be all about revealing the reality of this intelligence in Earth's past first.
Definitely. And one thing I want to add quickly is, not too long ago I googled or YouTubed, I think it was Anunnaki Mound Builders, and what came up is what you're talking about in your neck of the woods. And it was actually done, it was somebody that sort of chopped and put all these pieces together, but the main frame of this video was actually covered, I think, by Fox Morning News or something like that in the States there. Now what blew me out was this guy was reporting these mounds and was like, why the hell is no one covering this? And I don't know if this dude kept his job or not, but he did a very good presentation for what you would say for mainstream public to look at this and to go, this is real. This shows that all our history books are basically full of shit, and this proves it. And I was amazed that he was allowed to do this on mainstream TV. And I don't know, again, if he was allowed to do this or not. And obviously they would have had some inkling with this because they had people on the show. And I don't know how long it covered, but it would have been 2 or 3 segments this went for. So I was sort of pretty happy to see that this was being covered in a mainstream way. So, you know, that's something where slowly some of the stuff that we do talk about and why shows are done like this is to get out this knowledge. It's good to see that something like this was done on mainstream.
I think you're talking about Glenn Beck, right? And he was on the news there. And you know what was fascinating? He's fired, by the way. He did get fired.
He did get fired.
But what you find out is, you know, you've heard of the Mormon religion, right?
Yeah.
The Mormons. He was Mormon. And what we're talking about, I was told by the NSA people, the A.R. Borden people, if you don't look at the Book of Mormon as a religious book, look at it as the most accurate history book that's not been fiddled with by the Vatican. And that's truly what it is, because it tells of the story of the lost tribe of Israel coming here and intertwining into the Native American Indians. As a matter of fact, in the Mormon religion, I'm not Mormon, by the way, and I'm not, but this is going to be a big thing in the future, because this is going to validate a big chunk of the Mormon religion. Mm-hmm. Because in the Mormon religion, it says that this angel that appeared to Joseph Smith, who started the Mormon religion, told him that he had been a Native American Indian and incarnated many times, and told him the story of how the Indians were the remnants of the Mound Builders, who were the remnants of one of the lost tribes of Israel. And what I can tell you is, because of all this, and because of being brought into the fold of, you know, A.R. Borden's remote viewing group for the NSA, you know, these people who taught at the government level, you know, remote sensing and remote viewing, he said, Michael, you're sitting on top of the vortex right there in that area, and we don't even know how you could be living there, is what they said. Because truly, you find out, man, Native American Indians didn't live where these mound sites were. They knew that there was vortexes of energy, and if there's a vortex of energy, it's going to amplify whatever you bring into it, whether it's light or dark, unbiasedly, you know. So yeah, they would take great care before they entered an area to do ceremony. They would use sage, you know, and dance and clean their psychic vehicles of any fear or doubt or bullshit before they even entered these areas, because they knew better. And here we got a school sitting where this site was now just haphazardly. These kids, poor kids, they have no idea what they're sitting on. And I can tell you, because of the depression in this area and the loss of jobs and stuff, it's when you come into this area, it could be different. It could have been a heaven on earth, you know what I'm saying? But because of the depression that's here, like for instance, when I was working with the History Channel, I was in Boston, and one the night before I came home, we went out to a Boston pub, and I've never seen so much drunkenness and just people goofing off, but it was wonderful energy. Everyone was happy and blissful, and it was nothing but good cheer, you know. And I came home here the next day, and the minute I walked into this club, because I had to play a gig, it was like getting hit by a wall of depression before I even seen anyone in there, you know. And it's because this area, we're sitting in a vortex, and because of the economic situation and whatnot, it's very depressed in this area. And even you find out the Native American Indians, the first site of the mound builders was my hometown of Eastlake, Ohio. And that's what's going to be revealed here in the near future. Like I told you, what happened was the NSA people telling me, you know, you're sitting on top of the vortex. Well, I knew enough at that point that they knew where ley lines were, right? And they'd put either a mound complex or a temple or a pyramid there. So I'm thinking, well, where's my pyramid? You know, and it hit me. My mom worked for the city of Eastlake. I've born and raised in this city. And she told me of up on the hill, there used to be an Indian mound. So I went up there for the first time last year, and I parked my car. And sure enough, right at the front of the schoolyard was a monument. And it said this was where the Whitsley Indian culture was. You find out the Whitsley Indian culture, that's the name of the Army surveyor in the late 1800s that surveyed the site. That wasn't the name. Like, you'll hear this culture named the Hopewell Indians in Western Ohio. That's not the name of the Indians either. Hopewell was the name of the farmer who owned the land that these mounds were on. And they just became known as the Hopewell Indians. And what I can tell you is, because of now finding out this, the first site of the mound builders was in Eastlake, Ohio, and this place had walls that were 660 feet around it, which I can tell you, we'll get into this, why the number 660 is so significant, because it falls into this 432-based grid work of cosmic harmonious frequencies, and we'll get into that. But the walls were 660 feet. Which is massive if you think about it, with like a Cahokia type pyramid in the middle of it. And the reason I even know any of this is I posted some of this information on my Facebook wall, and I was contacted by the Eastlake Historical Society. And they said, we like what you're posting. We have some artifacts that were actually removed from this mound site if you want to come into City Hall and check them out. And I was like, well, heck yeah, you know. So I went in, and the first thing I seen was a newspaper article on behind these artifacts that said the mound builders were first in Eastlake, Ohio. Before they made the Serpent Mound, before they made the Newark Earthworks, they were here in Eastlake. And I thought, holy crap, you know, here's something no one knows yet. And that's what we're working on right now, because what I can tell you is the Cleveland Natural History Museum is going through a multi-million dollar renovation, and it is to reveal this Eastlake site as the home of the mound builders and who the mound builders truly are. They said that they're working on putting a label to the Hopewell and the Whitsley, because they're the same culture, because they're, you know, what I'm bringing to the table is all of these sites are incorporating and encoding these harmonious cosmic frequencies into all the sites. And the reason I can even tell you this is we've talked about now how 432 is the secret number. It's encoded into our even way of perceiving time down to a second, mm-hmm. where there's 43,200 seconds in 12 hours, which is 432. In 1940, we were brought into 440. And so a friend of mine who's come into my life, who is an Arcturian ambassador and has met the Arcturians face to face, we were having a conversation about 432 versus 440. And he said, "Michael, you know how we've been given this method of dividing or multiplying by 12, you know?" And I said, "Yeah, it's pretty apparent." He said, "Well, what happens when you divide 440 by 12? What you get is 36.66666666. And that's interesting, right?" And his own words were, "Wow, it's pretending to be sacred geometry. It's the closest to being a perfect number while still being an imposter." Mm-hmm. It's still not. He said, "What happens when you divide 432 by 12? Got out the calculator. It's a perfect 36. What you find out is 432, if you take 4 and 3 and 2 and add them together, it's 9, right? Mm-hmm. 216, 9. 108, 9. 54, 9. 27, 9. When you're at 432, if you want to go one half step up to any other note, you just add or subtract 9 to that number, and you'll get the accurate frequency of to go to an A flat or sharp, you know, up to a B. You know, in across the board, that's called the factor 9 grid. Well, take what we just discussed of 440 being divided by 12 equals 36.66666. Well, 432 divided by 12 is 36. 3 and 6 is 9. See what I'm saying? Nikola Tesla said, "Once we understood the magnificence of the 3, the 6, and the 9, we would unlock the secrets of the universe." 3, 6, and 9 is a different way of stating 432. They're forever interlocked. So because I was being put on this path of inquiry, I asked Chief Golden Light Eagle, the organizer of the Star Knowledge Conference, which next year will be the 20th anniversary. It's where all these Native American Indians have gotten permission from Spirit to begin releasing what they've learned from thousands of years of contact with these star visitors. And I said, "Chief, what does the Native American Indians have their instruments tuned to?" He said, "Some are 432, but some are 444. He said, "You need to look into 444 and how it relates to 528 and 432. And he said, "444 was an Arcturian number." And I said, "Well, that's interesting." Knew nothing what he was talking about, or even how to understand what he was telling me, that I needed to look into how 432, 444, and 528 were even related. Well, it hit me afterwards. I talked to him, and I was sitting here thinking about it, and I said, "I wonder if I took the same bed of info that the Arcturian was telling me of taking these whole numbers and multiplying them by 12, like we're saying, 36 times 12 is 432. 36.66666666 times 12 is 440. I thought, well, what's 37? You know, the next common, 37 times 12 is 444. Keep using the same bed of information, you get to 44 times 12 is 528. And I can tell you, this is a huge point, because there's some people right now, there's, you know how us humans do, we divide everything into two, and it's like, we know 528 is the real number, and those 432 people don't know what they're talking about. And the 432 people are going, "Oh, those 528 people, they don't know what they're talking about." And they turn it into a competition. What this is revealing, they're not in competition. They're in cooperation. They're perfect musical and mathematical overtones of one another that create perfect chords. But the reason I'm telling you this is, keep going now. You got 36 times 12 is 432. 37 times 12 is 444. 55 times, 44 times 12 was 528. Go up to 55 times 12 and it's 660. I just told you this Eastlake site had walls that were 660 feet long. Some of the circumferences of circles in some of these other mound structures are 660 feet. The walls are 1080. What they're doing is incorporating, the only common between these two methods of working out information based on the 432 frequency is 432. The way I like to even think of this is, think about if you break out the 432 into its octaves and you just place those numbers on a table. So in the middle, you got 432, and then you got 216, 108, 54, 27. But when you multiply whole numbers by 12, picture that going up and down through, like vertically through the plane of these numbers. And then you get 432 is the only thing that's common between the octaves of 432 and multiplying whole numbers. The only time that these two grids meet is 432. But then going up, you'll get 444, 528, 660. What isn't understood is these mound sites that are incorporating both methods of information that is encoded regarding the 432 frequency into the same structures. It blows my mind, and this is not known right now. So this is what I'm bringing to the board, and what I can tell you is, because of researching the East Lake site, which is, you know, where I live and where I've been filming all these UFOs. And by the way, how this all relates back to the UFO field, this gentleman, A.R. Borden, who you and I have talked about, who is the head of the remote viewing group and truly the person involved with Lockheed Martin Skunk Works in reverse engineering extraterrestrial technology that was then given to Colonel Corso to get out into the mainstream. We're talking, A.R. Borden is the focal point of this whole story. He said, you know what's sitting underneath you there in, you know, Northern Ohio, don't you? I said, no, not really. He said, it's the oldest underground base in the world, and it's not ours. He said, it's the Anunnaki's oldest underground base, and it sits underneath of Lake Erie. He said, one of the entrances, he said, the last time I was down there was, I think he said 2007. And he said, I took that long drive down Route 75 through Detroit. Well, I went and Googled Route 75 Detroit, and it dead ends into Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
God.
What he's telling me is there is one of those high, like, tech magnetic trains that will take you as an entrance point into this underground city. So I asked him, I said, well, what's it look like? You know, I'm all ears. And he said, imagine whole cities down underneath of us in this area. He said, picture that it has the architecture of like ancient Sumeria, of these temples and that type of architecture. He said there's huge, massive communal areas where they do the work and they all get together and eat and whatnot. But then there's hallways that offshoot off that into private living quarters of just small rooms that's where they go to sleep, and they have their own quarters when they go. You know, when people look into the Lake Erie UFOs, and what they'll find out is what's about ready to be revealed too is, you know, whatever this phenomenon is, our powers that be know. You know, I was contacted by Bigelow Aerospace, the owners of the Skinwalker Ranch, which I'm sure most of your listeners will know of. They're Bigelow Aerospace are the ones that, you know, Robert Bigelow bought the Skinwalker Ranch in the late 80s and staffed it. And I was contacted by one of their investigators, and they said, we know that what you're in contact with over Lake Erie is the real deal, because we know it's what we've been studying over the Skinwalker Ranch for 20 years. And I don't know if you know this, but, you know, John Alexander, which was the government liaison between Bigelow and the government, he was a high-ranking, I think, congressman. He said in a recent interview, they said, have you come to a conclusion? Because he's one of the people, he's the one that gave Robert Bigelow the authority to have all UFO reports go to Bigelow from the FAA.
Yeah, because the manual was diverted from the FAA to Bigelow Aerospace.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And John Alexander is the person who made that happen. And John Alexander is one of the only people that was allowed into the Skinwalker Ranch to, you know, witness what was happening there. And what he said was the weirdest thing, they call it poltergeist activity. And he said, like, for instance, they had three cameras, were all in eyesight, line sight of each other. And one time it was late at night, and they're sitting there watching the cameras, and within 1 second, there's a flash of light, and the very next second, the cameras were gone. They thought, what the hell happened, you know? So they went out and they said, not only were the cameras gone, but the duct tape that was holding the wires down was gone. It wasn't like it was laying on the ground or cut off, it was gone. And they said the weird thing was, all three of these cameras were in sight of the other cameras. And there were, these three cameras had a whole herd of cattle. This place was a cattle breeding for really high bred beef, you know, cattle. And they said that they were really skittish of people. Like if anyone even came around, they would scatter. And these cattle were totally unbothered by whatever happened. Whatever came in and took those cameras off the poles, it was like the cattle didn't even react to what it was. And they said, well, what do you think that that intelligence is? And he goes, the only thing that we could come to is we were in the presence of the trickster. Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing? That was his own words, is they had come in contact with the trickster. In the same way at Skinwalker Ranch, they said, you know, they staffed that place with the best money could buy, scientists, you know, and whatnot, and they lived there. So they had to go to the grocery store and buy their groceries, and they would come home and unpack all their groceries from the bags and put them in the refrigerator and the cabinets. And they'd walk out of the room and, I forgot to get something to drink, walking back into the kitchen, and everything that they just unpacked was back in the bags. It's like this intelligence was just messing with them, letting them know it's there, almost multidimensionally.
Oh, definitely. And that was NIDS, National Institute for Discovery Science, which Bigelow helped or create or fund. So indeed, there's a lot of stories. I actually heard something on a radio show somewhere not too long ago where they looked at the, it was like a couple of years ago actually, one of the security guards there was able to show his bona fide credentials and basically prove that he worked there. What was funny is that he was getting paid by the NSA, not Bigelow. Yeah.
The NSA are truly in charge of everything. People might not know that, but the NSA are the ones that are in charge of the world's military bases. Secret and not secret worldwide. They are truly the ones pulling the strings. And A.R. Borden was the unknown head of the NSA. You know, said when the Anunnaki come, they're not talking to Putin or they're not talking to Obama. They're talking about, they'll talk to our leading Nikola Teslas of the day who are starting to understand the physics of light and sound, and people who are truly on the cusp of understanding new life physics, as they called it, you know. And it was A.R. Borden, and A.R. said in 1954 is when he first started being in contact with these beings, and they used what they called intelligence acceleration on him very early, and because of this, he was truly one of the only, like the only person that they felt was intelligent enough to even have a conversation with them on the subject matter that we're talking about. Well, why this is even important is the idea of meeting a multidimensional being really hasn't been brought up. And you find out, you know, I found this out through Bigelow of, you know, what does the world's powers that be truly know? And he told me about the Bigelow Ranch, which them studying these orbs of light, they were called skinwalkers in the first place because the Native American Indians seen these orbs of light take on biological life forms, whether it was a large wolf, which like at the Skinwalker Ranch, these wolves would be the size of a small deer, yeah. You know, they were huge, but they were totally domesticated. They showed no sign of aggression towards humans. It's like you just came across the most friendly, peaceful German Shepherd you ever came across, but they were massive and giant. But the Native American Indians seen these orbs of light take on many different life forms, even porcupines and deer and wolves and biological life forms. Simultaneously, you got in the UK of their declassified information that they had noticed these orbs of light, three of them coming together and creating these huge triangular craft that have been seen worldwide right now. And the Arcturian spokesperson I told you I met walked me through the process of how these three orbs do create a triangular craft. Pretty much he said that you've heard of the Merkaba?
Yeah. Yeah, we've talked, you know? Yeah, we talked about this on the other shows, and it's very valid information. Please go ahead with this.
Yeah, right on. He said that, you know, the Merkaba is known as a interdimensional light vehicle that ascended masters use. They've learned through meditation and visualization techniques how to spend their energy fields or their auras or whatever you want to call it. The scientific term is the Meissner field, I found out. And you spin it in a specific way and your energy field around you turns into an orb of light. Little miniature sun that you're inside of, and the sphere will be 3 feet above your head and 3 feet below your feet. So if you're 6 foot, you're gonna have 11 or 12 foot sphere of light around you. So three of these beings can come together that are all creating Merkabas and create like a 50 foot sphere of light. They get into a triangular formation and they have an orb of the material between them that's just ready to turn back into light. It's a physical material that's the closest to turning back into light. And as the Arcturian guide told me, he said, you know how everything is truly light that's been slowed down in frequency to become physical? He said, imagine a physical material that was screaming to become light again. It's the closest physical material to tipping over the edge and turning into light. And he said, these three beings who are all creating massive amounts of energy through igniting their own Merkaba fields, would start doing infinity loops in and out of that material amongst the three of them, and willing energy through their crown chakras into the orb and then into the other guy and then back out of the crown chakra, back into the material, back into the other dude, and all three of them are putting energy into the orb where sooner or later it ignites into its own orb of light. And from that orb of light, they've created a miniature sun that is now sitting between the three. And that miniature sun, they can, because of the larger grid work of sacred geometry, the three of them are then forming, they can stretch that light out into a larger sphere that's about a 50-foot sphere of light. So if you see a sphere of light that's about the size of a house, there's three beams inside of it. If you see one that's about 11, 12 foot in diameter, it's one person. But three of those three-person spheres, three of the 50-foot spheres of light, so you got nine people, right? Mm-hmm. He said it's always three, six, and nine. I'm like, oh, there you have it. Nine of them can come together and in service to all the rest, create a craft that is miles long in some instances, like over Phoenix, of these huge triangular craft that then thousands of them can use to come here and see what mess we're making, you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. That in service, there's truly nine beings in there that are creating a physical craft from light into physical reality in service to the whole. And when they're done, you know, and they create a craft and all of them come down and they check out what they want, then they go back to the mothership and land, all the beings get out of there and it's back to the nine and they uncreate their Merkaba fields, yeah, and the whole ship disappears and they walk off and get a beer. You know, that's what we're talking about. And the reason I'm even bringing this up is, again, with the Bigelow and the Skinwalker Ranch and John Alexander saying the conclusion that they've come to is that they're dealing with the trickster. Then you take Bigelow Aerospace saying these orbs of light can become biological life forms, skinwalkers, deer, wolves. But in the UK, you got them saying the orbs of light become technological craft. You know, really what we need to wrap our heads around, we're dealing with an intelligence that can become anything physical.
Through thought.
And consciousness, through thought, yeah, and time. If they're outside of our space-time continuum, if they're multidimensional, then they could meet you as a child when you're two and give you a course of study and whisper something in your ear, pop out of this space-time continuum and wait till you're 30. Pop back in to them, only 1 second's passed since they talked to you when you're two to when you're 30, and give you another, you know, oh, I think he's ready for another piece. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is something that we're really, that's not being talked about really. We talk about these Anunnaki like they're horny space dudes, you know, which that's the lowest common denominator. Excuse me.
It's a lot more far out than what people can perceive, I think, when they first get into this. And it takes a lot to wrap your head around if you're not, you know, acquainted with any of this.
Indeed, it's a lot bigger picture, and you know, from what I understand, everything that they've told me is this is where we're heading ourselves in our evolutionary path. And they said there is no hierarchy to them. You know, we're not a lower life form like so many people want to put us in this category where, you know, Enlil looked at us as pests or whatever. They said it's not really accurate. They understand the acorn is no less significant than the giant oak it will one day become in the creator's eyes. There's just two different facets of evolution of the same intelligence that's evolving through time. And in the same way, they said they may be in ninth grade and we're in seventh grade, but to them, they know the seventh grader will become the ninth grader. And there ain't no like, nah, 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 I'm a ninth grader. You know what I mean? And the way I heard it told too is it said, like, take the cell in your toe. You know, that cell doesn't understand physical reality in the way you do. Like, take even your car, and which enables you to get around in your reality, and the cell in your big toe is what enables you to have your foot pressed down on the accelerator in your car and for you to experience this reality in whatever way that you are. So that cell in your toe will evolve to the same point of awareness and consciousness that the Peter that's talking to me right now will evolve into. And that much of a leap, if you can imagine such a thing in conscious evolution, who you are that's talking to me right now will keep evolving to just that great of extent from where you are now. Like, just the same way the cell in your toe can't imagine being in an airplane and what an airplane is, and that it's getting you from Los Angeles to Cleveland, you know? But in the same way, there's a much bigger picture, and we're just getting out of kindergarten, I think, you know? But I'm excited because we need to understand these things. It is understanding the bigger picture in a more realistic way of how consciousness becomes physical. And it fits in with our today's science of being quantum physics and knowing that belief and thoughts, you know, if you look into belief, what belief is your thoughts and feelings and emotions. So if you just take the word belief creates reality, it's saying your thoughts, feelings, and emotions create your physical reality. And what you concentrate and focus on determines what you experience. And, you know, there is no other main rule. You got to become responsible and look into where you're placing your attention. Exactly. As they say, you know, where you place your attention, energy flows.
Exactly. That is very correct. Now, I just want to ask a couple of things because we'll wrap it up soon. But is it 528 that your friend David Cerita goes on about? Because I had him on the show too, and he talks, I think it was 528. Out of the 444, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and what you find out is how I'm starting to understand it is these frequencies are not in competition with one another. They're actually showing us where to focus your attention for what you're trying to accomplish. If 432 baseline frequency of physical creation of light, and everything is light. They found out, you know, take atoms and put them into CERN or in an atomic accelerator, smash them together, there's gamma rays, it's light. Mm-hmm. Everything is light, but it's being slowed down. But as you've heard from David and other people, 528 is supposed to be the frequency of DNA. Mm-hmm. If you're going to work on DNA, it's specific. So I think it's showing us where, well, if you want to work on DNA, then you shift to 528.
Yeah,
if you want to work on the level of physical creation on an atomic level of light and sound creating physical reality, it's 432.
Yeah.
And if you want to go to 444, it's whatever the Arcturians are doing, according to Chief Golden Light Eagle. Yeah. Whatever 660 is, keep going. You're going to get to 55 times 12 is 660. I think that's why it's so important to make people realize these frequencies are not in opposition. They're perfect musical overtones.
They basically validate each other. They're part of something that we're trying to understand at the moment. It's not one or the other. It's, you know, like we talked about before doing the show, you know, we've just got to put everything on the table here and have a logic discussion about it. And this is where doing this, it puts it in the framework for people to, you know, put on to take it on board, so to speak, rather than, you know, just dismissing it. You know, it's, you know, put something on the plate, so to speak, that wasn't there before, and for a decent discussion and brainstorming on.
Right on, man. I think it's so important that let's figure it out together. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying I got all the answers, but I think this is where our conversations and discussion should be leading towards. So I think it's so important what you're doing right now, and giving us a, what would you say, a platform to discuss these issues and bring it up. And I think it's, you know, let's look into it together, everyone out there. We'll figure it out together. I think that's how it's supposed to be.
Now, just before we go, lately you visited the Serpent Mound and you had some helicopters flying around. Do you want to tell people a little bit about what was going on there if you can?
Yeah, man. I found out that these Earth Mound sites were put where there's active ley lines, you know, and ley lines are electromagnetic lines of energy that crisscross this planet. And when they cross, is, you know, there's a vortex of energy there, and they would usually put, you know, there's a vortex that's at Serpent Mound. So because of working with the Native American Indians, I found out where the vortex was, and I know that on the equinoxes, the most power that's possible, that's why they do their ceremony on the equinoxes at these places. And the equinoxes are actually marked in the structures of these sites that when they occur. So this fall, which was like 2 weeks ago, the fall equinox, I was at Serpent Mound, but there was no Native American ceremony. Like, they're going to be there next March. But it was interesting. This time there was none. And I'm thinking, I knew the September time frame was such an important time. It was during the whole time span that everyone was saying ascension would occur and all this stuff, you know. So I'm thinking, well, I'm going to do my own ceremony. You know what I mean? So I got right into the vortex, and I took my shoes off because energy from Gaia comes in through your feet. That's where chi comes into your body. And I got into the vortex, and I meditated, and I put out the intention for the best outcome for humanity possible. Out of all the infinite amount of outcomes that is out there, that we would experience the best one and be brought into the golden age as rippleless as possible. And once I was done, I got up and I dusted myself off and put my shoes on, and I went. And actually, as I told you, I met Marduk through a human vessel in a hot tub, and this was his wife that was with me, and we've been dear friends for about 20 years, you know. So she knew what I was doing, and this is Marduk's wife, right? So I go and sit down next to her, and she goes, you know what you did just now? The helicopters are going to be coming in to pick you up. She was just joking, right? Right after she said that, we heard the thumping of a helicopter, and it was a Black Hawk military, and it was right down over treetop level. Well, there's about 20 of us there that was at the sunset fall equinox area of Serpent Mound. They're waiting, watching the sun go down. Some of these people had heard her say, well, the helicopters will be coming for you. You should have seen the look on their faces. They turned around like, you just said that. How could you have known? And she's like, I really, I was just joking. You know what I mean? But the reality of the situation was a Black Hawk military helicopter came over right at treetop level, made two circles, and then came over directly straight over top of the Serpent Mound. And many pictures were taken, you know, and many people had their cell phones out, and it was so close I could see the people within the helicopter. And I gave them a peace sign, and it wasn't a one-fingered peace sign, by the way, it was a two-fingered real peace sign. It was really interesting because the night after that, I came into contact with some friends through the Native American Indian side who own the land directly that attaches to Serpent Mound, and it's called Soaring Eagle Resort, and they have huge festivals there. It's like a big, huge open field where they have carnivals and festivals and whatnot, and the only thing that separates that from Serpent Mound is a little rope. You know, you just step across that, and Serpent Mound is right there. So we actually, for the first time, stayed on the land that is attached to Serpent Mound. And in this field, by the way, there's mounds in this field, and there is a sundial, a sun calendar, that's underneath the ground still. It's not been unearthed, and they know it's there. This was part of the Serpent Mound complex. It's just not known. So there's no way to stay at Serpent Mound. You know, they closed the gate and no one's allowed there. So I felt very fortunate that I was allowed to stay on this land connected to Serpent Mound for 5 days and be in that energy. The second day, I had the lowest flyover I've ever experienced. And picture, you know, you're at the back of this field. Serpent Mound is behind you. You're looking at this huge field that is about maybe 4 football fields, maybe 6 all the way around. And all the way in front of you is a tree line, and over the horizon, you see this huge orb of light that was maybe, I don't know, about 20 times the size of the brightest planet you've ever seen in the sky. It was just massive. And it was pulsating. It would get really huge, and then it would go down to nothing. And then it would get huge, and it would go down to nothing. And it was going so slow, it took at least 7 or 8 minutes for it flew right over our heads, is what I'm saying. And it was noiseless. It was huge. And got really great photographs of that still. I'm waiting for my buddy to get some of his pictures from his iPhone to me. But it was mind-blowing because all of this led to me being invited to, man, this gets in a weird conversation. It was a museum of, this guy had one of the world's largest trilobite collections, these artifacts of one of the first life forms that ever walked out of the water and became on land. And his collection had been in the Smithsonian for the last 20 years. And for the first time, he'd gotten it out of the Smithsonian and it was back at his house. I don't know anything about trilobites. I don't know anything why they're so, you know, special. But I can tell you, when I walked into the place, I felt like I was in a sacred space. I was like, whoa, what the hell's going on, you know? Then I found out what was around me. Well, this lady was the head of the Serpent Clan for the Mound Builder, Native American Indian Clan. And the Serpent Clan is Inki's clan from the Anunnaki, the Mound Builders. And make a long story short, I was brought into the Serpent Clan as an official member by them. She sang like pretty much like a 2-minute long Native American Indian chant song for each one of my chakras. And it was beautiful. It brought me to tears. And welcomed me in to their group of people officially. And at the end of it, she told me how to take the Serpent Mound's own energy into my body and activate my own DNA. And what I found out was there's a ley line and a fault line. So you find out Serpent Mound is right on a 5-mile-long meteorite impact crater. And this ley line, this fault line, runs right through the serpent's mouth of the Serpent Mound. And they said that when they get extreme weather that comes through that valley, like they said, usually sometimes they'll get this 90-mile-an-hour wind that comes through. And when it does, it activates that ley line, and they have actual electricity that's been seen coming from the ground up out of this fault line, going lightning coming out up into the sky. And by the way, this dude, Thomas, he's been on Ancient Aliens because of the Serpent Mound. He's one of the world's most renowned experts into this field. So he's the one that told me really what's going on is through the serpent's mouth, this ley line goes through. So it's a very energetic spot, and there's this, I don't want to just give it away right now, but there's a very specific thing to do. And at that ley line, you know, at that point, and you can take the energy right up into your physical body. And I did that. The last day we left was Sunday. And I sure as heck wasn't, you know, I learned this Saturday night. So I got up at 7:30 before anybody was even over there. And I went over to the Serpent Mound all by myself. And I did what I was instructed to do. And I took the energy of the serpent right into my crown chakra. And boy, I've had a energy high ever since.
Awesome.
And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. No, thank you for sharing that. But we'll wrap it up now. Michael, it's always a pleasure talking to you and connecting, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, and you keep up the great work as well. I see that you're a pioneer in spreading the message yourself, so keep on keeping on.
Yeah, you too, keep it up, and we'll stay in touch, and again, muchly appreciate your time.
Right on, brother.
Thanks, mate. Talk soon.
Peace. Bye-bye.